Faithful listeners, you may be wondering why we've gathered you all together tonight. In the living room with the television are me, Peter Bell.
Me, James Willits.
Me, Caleb Woodbridge.
And I, Swithin Dobson.
But rather than a murder, we are here for a podcast of impossible things. Welcome. Tonight, we're looking at The Unicorn and the Wasp, another historical celebrity with Agatha Christie, and the seventh episode of this series. Guys, what were your general thoughts of the episode?
I wasn't very impressed. Again.
Are you ever impressed?
Yeah, when are you impressed?
I was impressed by Magnolia, which I watched a few days ago. It was a very good film.
What and about John Silver's
Hill? Not quite the same programme.
When was that I was impressed? I don't really remember, to be fair.
1969.
That was that's quite possible.
I was plumping for 73, but I was... it raised a very good point, though, isn't it? Because we were discussing, just before we started the recording, the so-called curse of Episode 7, which has been raised by all of us individually, but also online, the seventh episode of each series of Doctor Who since the programme came back. Has generally been considered to be the weakest of the lot.
Well, not necessarily the weakest of the lot, just a bit average.
Right, okay, so not quite up to scratch,
yeah,
though.
Because The Long Game, it was okay, nothing particularly special, same with Idiot's Lantern, 42, just a standard run around, basically, in space. But I felt that this episode bucks that trend. I thought it was a lot more fun. It stood out a lot more. It was good. It was entertaining. And I think moving the celebrity historical, as it were, to this middle episode slot did break that curse of Episode 7, if you want to put it in those melodramatic terms in the best Doctor Who tradition.
Gave it something a little bit more memorable, basically.
Yeah, I agree with Caleb, actually. In fact, I'd go as far as to say that it was the best of the series so far. I really, really, really enjoyed it, particularly coming off the back of the dross that was the Doctor's daughter. I felt that, you know, there was only one way to go and that was up, but it pleasantly surprised me by being genuinely quite good.
Yes.
I remember the last time I was impressed by Doctor Who.
Ah, okay.
That would be Blink and the Ed Sheldon Doctor's dances. The last two times I was impressed. I have been impressed sometimes.
Fair enough. Okay. No, all impressive episodes. I think that's true enough. I agree with James and Caleb in that of the Episode 7 crowd, I think Unicorn and the Wasp is certainly the best of the batch. And Agatha Christie is an interesting choice for a historical celebrity. In that people don't really know much about her particularly, but know her work an awful lot, which you could say probably took more of the limelight in this episode than she did herself, but we'll get on to that as we get into the episode. As a piece of sci-fi drama in itself, better than most of the rest of the series. For those of you who are regular listeners, of course, I've been away for the past couple of weeks, so have only... just in the last couple of days caught up with 3 weeks' worth of Doctor Who. By the time I got halfway through The Doctor's Daughter, I felt like just switching the television off, crawling into a corner and crying softly to myself.
Oh, it wasn't that bad.
Oh, it was worse.
Yes, it was.
I did quite like the bits of filming in Big Pit that they did there. And although the scenes where they got to the surface looked as though they really had come to the surface and were filming in Blaine Avon as well, in that it was just this arid, grey wasteland. But appropriately enough, The Doctor's Daughter filming in Big Pit, you honestly could say that they'd hit rock bottom and started digging. Sorry, that was my contribution to last week's podcast, a week late. But getting back on to this week's, it was good. I think it was probably the best of Series 4 so far, but that is saying something in that had it appeared in Series 2 or 3, or Series 1 come to that, it would have just been filler. It wasn't particularly outstanding in, under its own merits, but it wasn't bad. But we will get into this in far more detail as we go through the episode. So,
Kelly, so should we hit play?
Yes,
why not? The neon lights yet again.
We've got to ask, who's going to be the next writer that they decide to cover?
They have gone with literary figures. Really.
Yeah, I'm thinking possibly Tolkien.
Chaucer would be fun.
Like Chaucer would be good. I was thinking Tolkien with maybe some actual goblin orc invasion stuff.
C.S. Lewis. Although they'd probably make him gay.
well, you could have the whole thing of, a ordinary object that leads to other worlds. Now there's a good idea for
this
a story.
This is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, this is quite nice and jolly, the 20s setting. Very brisk.
And straight away, the music, and Smithin has been commenting on this over the weeks, the incidental music in this series really has been a step up from previous years.
Yeah, I didn't notice the music the first time around, but now listening to it, it is nice. Nicely period. Mm.
They seem to be moulding it to set the tone of each particular week.
Better than they have been doing.
All this work will be the death of you. Ooh, is that a clue?
Slightly. He might as well have turned up with a Star Trek original series red shirt on.
Yeah, Professor Peach. Peach is the new red shirt.
And here we see something of what I was saying about perhaps the genre rather than the author being the star, in that it's obvious from the very beginning.
I love this. Professor Peach in the library with the lead piping, and the giant wasp. A giant wasp using a lead piping. I mean, that is hilarious.
How did it hold the lead piping?
Well, it's an alien wasp.
Of Colonel Mustard. That's why it's yellow.
Yeah.
This is
a bit I didn't guess on the first watching. It appeared to me that the silhouette on the wall was very definitely still a human hand holding the piece of lead piping as it swung down. Yet it's intercut with a giant wasp. I thought maybe is the character Professor Peach hallucinating and seeing a giant wasp as he's actually being clubbed to death.
I was expecting them not to show the wasp and just see him die and then just do the eyes and then kind of see who he was. That's what I was expecting, to be fair.
Because when we find the body later on, he has actually been bludgeoned to death on the head. He hasn't been stung at all. So why the character needs to change into a giant wasp at all is a little one.
Watch out, that's David Tennant's dad there, that waiter.
Aww, is it really his father?
Yes.
Ah, that's lovely.
I didn't know.
He was down to see the film and visit his son.
I was just thinking, we're saying about the...
It's Felicity Kendall.
Indeed, looking as young as she ever did, really.
As you say, we have the all-purpose sonic screwdriver. Screwdriver. We now have the all-purpose psychic paper, which seems to resurrect itself pretty much every week. To get him out of any situation possible.
Well, it's more to get him into situations.
Yes.
Yeah.
And notice the recurring character of the policeman that is obviously just his favourite pastime, pretending to be the local constabulary.
I would just like to sing the praises briefly of the psychic paper. I think it's one of the best inventions of the new series.
Henry Gordon Jago.
Christopher Benjamin.
Fantastic.
Familiar to classic Who fans as Henry Gordon Jago from Towns of Weng Chiang.
And Sir Keith from Inferno.
Ah, indeed, yes.
Fantastic.
And the worst setup.
Gaydar alert! Gaydar alert! That was so obvious.
It was subtle.
Don't object, otherwise you're homophobic.
Oh, obviously. Obviously. Someone said on that post, Gallifrey, if you're not gay here, you're a Nazi.
We should raise the gay agenda issue here. Or not so much the gay agenda issue, just the gay issue.
It's not been a noticeable thing this season, actually. This is the first time that it's really...
They seem to have got over it somewhere.
Yeah.
They don't feel the need to remind
us. I love the idea of the gay agenda. Obviously, somewhere in BBC Wales, there's a pink clipboard, probably with leopard skin backing. And they're plotting away, obviously. It's a bit of a Yeah, it's a bit of a cliche
they have
among
meetings or something.
It's a bit of a cliche among fans, but they do. Sometimes it's not terribly subtle. And this episode is one.
Yes. Although, in its favour, I do get the impression that they've deliberately dispensed with the subtlety here because it comes out, so to speak. And it's a poor choice of phrase, but I can't think of anything better to use. Pretty early on, and is made quite stunningly obvious. You could ask whether or not it serves the plot in any way, shape or form, because it doesn't really... I don't know, it doesn't add to the character particularly. It's not a secret from the viewer's point of view that needs to be revealed. It's not a red herring or anything.
Well, it fits in with some of the themes of the episodes about British Reserve and so on. But we have Fenella Wilger as Agatha Christie, has made her appearance.
Yes, our historical celebrity has made her appearance, indeed. And she's very, very good in this episode, I must say.
Yeah, she was quite impressed, to be fair.
I think she's just generally brilliant.
She was very good in Jekyll.
In Jekyll, she was fantastic.
Stephen Moffat, of course.
And she's playing this character perfectly straight as well, where all of the secondary characters are quite obviously deliberately two-dimensional pantomime.
Two-dimensional clichés.
That was interesting. You brought up, the genre versus the kind of, the history kind of aspect. Mm. Of this and how it is advancing the plot of any way. And we found that he's dead.
He's dead.
Yeah. How do we think it works as trying to basically not necessarily be historical, but being sort of a take on the TV adaptations, murder mysteries, as opposed to the history in any way.
And here we have the spinning newspapers, and it's adopting these. Conventions of the genre, and I quite like this. It does make it this combination of the Doctor Who genre colliding with the murder mystery genre. That is quite fun. That's quite different.
And because it's intentionally tongue in cheek, I think that it does stave off the criticisms that could have come from it to it if it had not been so obviously pleased with its own ingenuity, really. Mm. And I think that it does work it quite well.
The central conceit, effectively, is Agatha Christie, along with the Doctor and Donna, step into one of her own stories.
Yes.
Isn't it?
And they comment on this in just a moment. Donna does. Yeah, here it comes.
Yes.
And this is actually a plot point that is later developed.
I do think it would have been better if they'd played a bit of a game that the viewers could have joined in with a couple of obvious clues that you could follow and piece together, to come up deliberately with the wrong conclusion, and they then pull a twist on you.
I think they do a fairly good job of setting up mystery in 45 minutes, which is obviously going to be very difficult. You do have the challenge of introducing the characters and giving a few details. And I think, given the constraints that they're working under, they do that.
Mm.
Here we are. Really here's well. Donna. Here's Donna saying that it's a bit weird.
It's quite interesting.
Nice little back reference to them quite dead.
Yes. There were some lovely, lovely scenes in this. I must admit, this
I really enjoyed this bit.
Tell me there's no noddy.
I found that just a bit too much. Is there no noddy? Please slap her now.
No, I thought that was just...
Well, you never know. Maybe that is going to be the next literary thing.
Noddy.
Noddy.
In a bite. This is a good little moment coming up where Agatha Christie tells the Doctor off for treating this as something for his own entertainment rather than...
Yes.
For the sake of justice. And you have the same with Queen Victoria. And I do think that, unlike perhaps the old series where the Doctor didn't have control of the TARDIS and so he was more of a wanderer, now he is more of a tourist. And so there is this sense in some of the episodes that he's out for a laugh, for a good time, rather than being this wanderer with a burning sense of justice and so on.
Oh, they're telling you something we didn't know at this point. He's gay. Again. Now, this is something
Let's not labour the point.
I'm not. It moves on to a point I'm liking to make. It's clear, as you pointed out, this is not supposed to be a historical proper, but it's based on a story. But, Agatha Christie's stories. But what annoyed me intensely is you can never do any historical period at all and show them to be reasonable people. For example, the Idiot's Lantern being the best example of this, that all evil misogynists in the 1950s who hate people who aren't white.
Except for the hopelessly wet behind the ears teenage boy.
Yes, precisely. And you get the scene later on when I think the butler dies. Is it the butler dies?
Well, discuss that when it comes.
Yeah, no, but it moves in with the point. So Donna says, oh, we can't even mourn a death. It's like the Dark Ages. And it's like, yeah, we're supposed to go, yeah, it is the Dark Ages because we're not doing a Princess Diana and everyone's upset about something they never knew and put flowers on the street.
I think wasn't the point more the fact that it was the gay guy's friend and that he can't mourn it because he can't openly say I am gay and therefore, and you know, I like this
that
guy.
One?
I think that was more the point that they were trying to make. Interesting there that they showed for the first time the unicorn, and the fact that she has a gun, which is never referenced again. That would probably have been quite useful in the battle against the giant wasp. But was just used as a throwaway, she's evil.
There is a little literary truism, and I forget who said it. Caleb can probably
tell us. Chekhov's rule about the gun scene in the first act must be fired in the
third.
Yes,
that's it. If you're going to show something in the first act, make sure you use it in the third.
But I do think it's just setting up that she's up to something, and that does get paid off.
Yes, but it would have been better maybe had she had the lock picking tools that are shown later
instead.
Given away too directly.
Well, having said that, it's been preying on my mind this past 24 hours.
It's been this little flashback with the Doctor again with Bow and Arrow. Is it the same adventures in Blink?
Potentially. I was wondering that.
Charlemagne. I've got a very good memory. That's a good
The wit in this, I mean, the comedy elements I thought worked particularly well.
Yeah.
One scene in particular, which we'll see coming up later.
Comedy.
Yes. And he has, of course, used this British stiff upper lipness to very good effect in The English Way of Death, which is one of his missing adventure novels featuring Tom Baker's Doctor in the hiatus period years ago. One of the best Doctor Who tie novels that I've read to this day, I think, although I haven't read half as many as Caleb, so you can probably pick half a dozen others.
I've not read that one, so I can't comment directly.
Yeah, lovely use of the musical cues here again.
That doesn't make much sense considering the Doctor said before that she was a plucky girl who helped him and Scotland Yard because she obviously wasn't a member of Scotland Yard because they weren't any. But when she says Scotland Yard, assuming that she's from it, he accepts that's the case, even though he's a lot older than her. Well, doesn't make much sense.
Maybe she's just been associated with Scotland
Yard.
Yes. I think it works. I think that's
if you don't let me in here, I'll go and get the Doctor, and he is Scotland Yard.
I suppose. But
all right, I need to investigate. You just
the claw.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, good to see Donna taking a strong lead again, even though it's under the Doctor's initial direction. She is going out and finding clues.
And we get another reference to the missing bees here.
Oh yes, indeed.
So yeah, I wonder where that's going. Someone was speculating, oh, perhaps bees are attracted to roses.
The tenuous link.
Then why wasn't she covered in bees?
Oh, and it's pretty good.
The CGI in this is rather effective, it has to be said.
There's something quite scary about wasps anyway, and quite alien about insects. That's a bit...
I think it's a little longer than that.
Yeah, the magnifying glass is a ray gun to...
I mean, it takes ages to try and kill bugs with them. I tried it years ago. It takes at least 3 minutes.
Swithin, this says rather too much about you.
There may be psychologists listening to
wings from insects as well.
I didn't do that.
Torturing kittens.
Isn't that how Hannibal Lecter started?
That's so funny.
Now, biologically, I know it's an alien wasp from another galaxy,
yeah,
but wasps don't actually leave their stings in people when they sting. Bees do. Wasps don't.
Ah, yes, but then it kills the bee, doesn't it?
Yes.
So it rips their own insides out.
Well, it kills our bees.
But it is a vespiform.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So it's an alien wasp.
Also, I think the insinuation is that it shouldn't leave its sting inside there. It's just that if it broke off and it can regrow it, rather than that's its method of killing. A nice Agatha Christie reference there, Cat Among the Pigeons.
Oh yeah, we haven't been counting off.
No,
we should have had a little tally, really.
What do you think about the kind of portrayal of Agatha Christie herself in this, and like a general kind of place in history as a literary figure?
I think as a character, she...
this was terrible. This
she could have moved, couldn't she?
Yeah.
Sorry, that was terrible.
She had at least 5 seconds standing staring at the gargoyle
It reminded me a bit of... In Hot Fuzz and the obviously much less gruesome. It just
that
lands,
was unnecessary.
Lands nicely on her stomach rather than on her head.
Oh, we're just saying Hot Fuzz. Hot Fuzz is actually in a comedy. She's aimed at the mass market, which actually says something reasonably deep in it.
I've not seen it yet.
But that's going completely off topic.
Really? What does it say that's reasonably deep?
Well, no, in his portrayal of... the village and it's basically an anti-conservative film.
Okay.
And you've got the village and you've got killing all these undesirable people, and I'm going off topic there, so I won't. But Agatha Christie is a literary figure.
I think as a character she's shown really well. I'm a bit dubious about what you see later with the she's the best selling human author in the galaxy of all time type thing, which I think is pushing things a bit far in terms of her literary status.
Because if we remember when the Doctor left Dickens back in series one, he told him that his works endure forever and are always read. So is this perhaps, and I think he said something similar to Shakespeare the last series as well, so are we... Is he going to say this to every literary figure that he meets?
Who's going to appear next to him? That's the question.
We sort of touched on it briefly already.
What would be quite nice would J.K. be Douglas Rowling. Adams.
Oh, that would be good.
That would be very fun, actually.
Although perhaps a bit too recent, and also in terms of his memory.
Have any of you read any Agatha Christie?
Yes.
I've
not, I have to confess.
What's the general opinion just on her?
On her as a writer? I really, really liked her. I haven't read her for a few years, but I went through a stage of reading quite a lot of her books, and I enjoyed them a lot. They're very clever, they're very well done, and they do set the bar, really, for that kind of murder mystery tale.
This is another really good scene for Donna and for Agatha Christie. I'm referring back to The Runaway Bride.
Mm.
just brings out that side of her character quite nicely.
She's generally, Catherine Tate has proved herself to be very strong in the one-on-one scenes. She's, I think that she has done surprisingly well, particularly as this is the first the first episode that they shot after The Runaway Bride.
Well, after Voyage of the Damned. But
well, yes, with Catherine Tate after The Runaway Bride. I think that it's nice to see that, you know, considering how much people were anti her on the basis that she was going to be shouty and screamy, she's really managed to not be that and excels really at these quieter scenes.
I think she's adds an awful lot of depth to a series which has been somewhat lacking in any sort of profundity thus far. These two, you know, together here with Donna and Agatha Christie speaking together. But two terrific performances side by side.
And mature adults having a mature conversation.
Whereas had this been last season, the conversation would simply have been Martha telling Agatha about
how lovely the
doctor is.
But she doesn't notice hints. Blokes never notice hints. Doesn't make any sense. Be blatant. But interestingly, we show lack of profundity in the series so far. What's quite interesting, in my opinion, Agatha Christie, not read her for a while, is that the structure of the stories is excellent. And the way it's written, the technicality and the engineering is fantastic. Now, just thinking about this season thus far, we've had, in my opinion, it's basically just being entertainment overall, everything. Anything should attempt to be kind of amusing or light and accessible has been the primary thing, with very little structure and even less profundity.
Well, I think they have done some darker stuff to some extent.
Yeah, but darkness does not mean
darkness. I know, I was about to say that darkness doesn't mean death, but I think...
See Torchwood.
I wouldn't say it's all been light.
No, I wasn't saying, but I think in general, it's just kind of from Peter's comment and just putting it in with...
I quite like this bit with the Doctor's being
We interrupt the commentary for what I think is probably the best scene of certainly this episode and probably the season so far.
Do you?
I think this was lovely. The charades scene in the kitchen.
Ginger beer. Queer.
Lashings.
It is. Cockney riding slang. It is.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would just like to disassociate myself from the Smith and Dobbs.
Not necessarily the rest of the commentators. But this is it.
So
I really like
So we
scene.
Like this.
He wants a hand job. Sorry, that just slipped out.
the opinions of these about it are not necessarily
I was doing so well on my little moral high horse.
Caleb and I are disassociating ourselves.
We'll just bask in the glow of relative... yeah, whatever.
I just thought this was too over the top for his own good. Oh no, and why is any excuse to get some tongue action with the Doctor?
But this was far better than the genetic transfer with Martha back in Series 3.
That's very true.
And impossible. Merely very unlikely.
Yes, I did like that. That was very enjoyable. But where were we before
we descended to the depths?
No idea. I was just thinking about structure with Agatha Christie and then kind of style with this, and then profundity. Is
I think. It's true that the emphasis is more just straightforward entertainment sort of surface style, as it were, rather than generally intricacy of plotting or depth of things or so on. And I think they do it very stylishly in all kudos to them for that. I'm not down on that, but I do think it's a pity that we can't have both that and a bit more in the plot. And this is probably one of the best plotted, just because of the whodunit conventions require that tighter plotting.
What's very interesting with the murder mystery theme is that Doctor Who in its old incarnation in general was actually quite a mystery based programme. It was generally a mystery regarding what things were happening, how it was, and how the Doctor would eventually solve it and sort it out. It was a very kind of mystery based kind of programme, really. More so than any other adjective you could give to it at the time.
Considering this theme of depth or lack of in this series so far, they have been raising an awful lot of quite big, profound, and in many cases quite worthy issues and topics, but then don't seem to be doing anything particularly exciting or interesting with them. They just skate across the surface, and I get the impression that as long as they've mentioned them or treatment in an incredibly cursory manner, then that's as far as they need to go. They don't actually deal with
such as the issues they raise. Had slavery, and you've had the
war as well.
War and being a soldier.
And guns being bad.
I did think they did a better job in The Doctor's Daughter of the whole war themes than in the Sontaran story. But that's not really saying much. But they did... again, there was a lot of potential there that wasn't developed, wasn't capitalised on, to integrate it into the story.
Yeah. Right. I'm beginning to agree more and more with him in that I think... Don't look so surprised.
I'm shocked at that as well.
In that the 45-minute format is so limiting. The Doctor's Daughter should have been a two-part story. It would probably have been awful over
2 weeks.
Two weeks instead of just one. But they could have at least got into the meat of the story.
Mm.
This war of attrition that serves no real function. The fact that the Doctor suddenly finds himself with what's effectively an adoptive daughter that he comes to care for and look after and things like that. Mm. As opposed to skipping all through it in the space of half an hour.
But do you not think that it's a problem of the quality of the writing and plotting rather than the limited time frame? Because there are episodes where that time frame is sufficient to tell a good story.
I agree.
And I think that possibly it's that they bite off more than they can handle. To do something like war and fatherhood at the same time was ridiculous. Maybe had they concentrated on one, then it would have been a lot more sensible.
I felt with The Doctor's Daughter you had different elements, and they... I thought the stuff with the Doctor getting to grips with that he's got a daughter and so on, that was pretty good, but it was badly integrated with the sort of B plot of, oh, this eternal war of attrition in the background, which was absolute bobbins. It was just, there was some stuff that was really good, but it was badly worked in with the rest. I think this has a much greater unity of themes and action, just it's a lot more straightforward.
Yes, no, that's true. And think about it, coming with a title like, and this is talking about the series, in broader sense as opposed to just this episode, perhaps The Doctor's Daughter should simply have been almost a bottle episode, a more human drama without the whole eternal war, is there a just cause for conflict, things like that. And as brief aside, why is it that as soon as she's unmasked, she develops this awful Cockney accent?
Because Cockneys are criminals.
Yes, it's basically stating that only the lower orders and
she's
can be criminals.
Common, she keeps the jewel in her bra or something.
Yeah, it's because all common people do that.
Yeah. There are no upper class criminals.
I do enjoy the fact that Donna is sat in the background eating and watching this as though it were theatre or a film.
It is fun having the whole "we've gathered you here together" scene.
The parlour room reveal.
They really do seem to be having fun with it.
Well, they can't do like David Suchet.
And this is quite funny.
His best moment in the episode.
Yeah, his criminally anti-moment. I mean, he was brilliant as Henry Gordon Jago, and it would be lovely to have seen him have a character that could be fleshed out more.
Why do they criminally underuse actors with a lot more charisma than anyone in the main cast? Like, yeah. Bernard Cribbins and him.
Bernard Cribbins, the Series 5 companion.
Yes, indeed.
Bernard Cribbins for the Series 5 villain.
This chap for the Series 5 companion.
Yes! Why not? Let's go back, pick up Henry Gordon Jago. From the Tanzanian.
Well, they did a spin-off with Professor Lightfoot and Harry Gordon Jago. I think it was in a comic, if I remember right.
Didn't they?
Yeah, they were two spin-off characters who were going to do some more with, but they didn't eventually.
Who did?
With Henry Gordon Jago.
Yeah, who did that then?
Oh, I can't remember who it was.
Yeah, I've heard talk, would it be nice if they did do a spin-off, but I didn't know.
I thought they might have intended to do it and they didn't, or something like that.
That would have been terrific. Here we come to the final revelation of exactly what's been happening.
Well, Agatha Christie works out what's going on the ordinary level, the pregnancy, human stuff, and then
the doctor provides the extraterrestrial sci-fi side of it. And neither side works particularly well, in my opinion.
Oh, I thought it brought it together. Pretty nicely. What did you think didn't work?
Well, as we'll see, the idea of the illicit pregnancy out in Delhi. She met this man who fell from the stars. He turned into a giant wasp, but she loved him anyway and had his giant wasp baby.
It is weird that she was in love with the giant wasp.
Yes.
That is true.
He was such a nice giant wasp, it didn't matter that he was a giant flying insect. How does a giant wasp mate with a human woman anyway?
Makes Beauty and the Beast sound high art.
It does.
Beauty and the Beast is high art.
She comes back. Well, the original.
Disney version. I've always seen it.
The Disney version, Oscar nominated.
It's beautifully animated.
It's fabulously well done.
Okay.
How gay did that sound? It's fabulously well done.
You've just given me the references in the program again.
But anyway,
some nice old evil effects.
With the pink.
Yeah.
Again.
The alien pink lighting, it seems to be all over, doesn't it?
They seem to be giving us schizophrenic with their gayness and the pink. You just can't see anything to get for the balance.
Calm down, Swithin.
Swithin's got a gay thing going.
It's Swithin's gay agenda.
I'm actually wearing a pink shirt at this point as well.
But just the idea of she comes home to Britain, has the giant flying wasp baby, which is like a very quick and cheap version of David Cronenberg's The Fly, or The Fly 2, to be more specific. Is born as a human baby, is given away, adopted, that's fine. And he's a giant flying wasp version of the Incredible Hulk. Whenever he gets angry, he turns into a giant wasp and kills people. This doesn't happen until he's well into his 30s. At which point, the locket...
Well, he is a vicar.
From birth.
Well, there's some people who are sort of middle-aged.
Maybe it's some kind of larval stage.
The roving finger of evil
of accusations.
It's quite fun.
Yeah.
This
whole thing is being acted out like a murder mystery, which
means it was you. And well directed by Graham Harper.
Yes, probably his best work so far this series. I felt his work on Planet of the Huge was okay, but nothing spectacular.
He hasn't had anything as good to work with as he had with Revelation of the Daleks or Gaze of Androzani, though, has he?
No. Or Army of Ghosts or Doomsday, come to that. The big showy set pieces. But from a director's point of view, pure gold, surely.
I can't remember much.
See, the sci-fi explanation here doesn't carry any weight. The locket that Felicity Kendall is wearing contains the baby flying wasp thing's Baby Vesper form, let's say. Baby Vesper forms psychic mental matrix. Why? Why does it beam his alien consciousness into his body as soon as he hulks out, for want of a better word?
Also, why are these people stealing the cheapest parts of the church?
Because they're a bit thick. And we'll have to get into the fact that the vicar is so obviously wet behind the ears in a minute. But why does the locket have Agatha Christie's medical matrix stored within it?
Because she was reading the book.
I think it just absorbed it from its surroundings.
So she was reading Agatha Christie for 6 months.
No, it was because of the moment of transfer.
Yeah.
Yes, but then it should have really beamed Felicity Kendall's mental matrix over, because Agatha Christie was nowhere near her. She was reading an Agatha Christie novel, but if I read a Terry Pratchett novel, that does not give me the ability to read Terry Pratchett's mind.
However, had you been reading that whilst the Firestone went off, he would have, started to act out Terry Pratchett's plots. He would have become a wizard.
An author's plots and an author's characters are not the author's mind. They are from the author's mind. They're not the author's personality.
What's that got to do with it? Because it's basing his actions on the plot, not on Agatha Christie's mind.
Yeah.
So I don't see...
At this point, yes, but later on, as the chase ensues, the Doctor saying that... Agatha Christie has a direct psychic link with the Vesper form. How can it possibly have this?
I think it's because she's got the locket at that time. But
this isn't made clear. Which it should be, really.
Well, let's watch. It's nice to have a story where it isn't about saving the world, but it is about a particular group of characters. It shows that you can tell an interesting story without having to have the fate of the universe at stake every week.
Mm. No, very true indeed.
the bit where he says this has been a most entertaining evening. I saw that in the trailer. I thought he's evil because on TV, religious people in general, they're either irredeemably wet and or hypocritical and or
raving lunatics.
Yes. So it's a bit of a cliche. But more of a TV cliche than a whodunit cliche.
What do we think about Mr. Wet Vicar then?
He's wet. What more can you say?
Yeah, Paul Cornell was commenting on this in his podcast because he's a Anglican pagan, and so he's
does that work?
He doesn't like the portrayal of religious people. It's often terribly stereotyped. But I think it was fairly well handled. It's not a particularly bad offender.
A poor bit of editing here. I say a poor bit of editing. No, what am I talking about? I'm talking nonsense. I don't like the way that the Doctor and Donna appeared to effectively lock everyone in the house with the giant wasp. It did look as if they were running away and trying to save themselves from a fate. Of giant stingy thing.
I think it's more that they're trying to get the locket away.
This is true.
History is in flux.
Yes, when I wanted to be, it looked the stakes.
It's basically a writer's device.
The laws of time are the laws of drama.
Yes. In Doctor Who.
There is little consistency.
Any ideas why it's called the Silent Pool they're going to? Because it's been in there for a while. I can think of anything.
I'm not sure.
It's a silent pool and it goes through it twice?
Isn't it? Possibly something from an actual novel.
It might be. I haven't read it for like 6 months. She was reading The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
Yeah, it's because she's controlling it with that Headlining to sleep.
Okay, I see.
Which I haven't seen for a while.
That's fine. I missed that the first time around.
Oh, it's Into the Lake.
And Donna kills it.
Yes.
Yay, dead wasp. Well, we all know the best way to kill wasps though is to put sugar in there as well. Sugar and water.
Ah, I didn't know that. Oh, because they're still attracted
by the sugar. Sugar, yeah. See, not only can I kill little insects, I can kill wasps as well.
We're all shuffling down the sofa away from Swithin.
It's funny that she should kill the wasp in a very similar way to the killing of the arachnos, flushing it down the plug hole, basically, to the centre of the earth.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. The doctor is slightly upset about the fact that she's killed it.
Oh, bad pun there from the doctor. Murder at the vicar's rage.
There we are. Again, with the alien pink lights, there is an awful lot of this going around.
Yeah.
Pink is obviously in fashion in...
it was blue travel. For a while.
Yeah, well, yeah,
the special effect colour de jour.
Maybe they can only afford one colour.
You can't afford another colour filter.
No.
If you notice during the McCoy era, they seem to have an awful lot of green paint for their props and stuff.
It's where the home base had gone.
But it does tie together the different elements nicely here.
The Harrogate Hotel.
Do you know where they actually found her car parked?
No.
It was next to a quarry, not a lake.
Was it?
Yep.
Josh, you know anything about what was supposed to happen to her, really, or not?
No, I don't.
Did she ever actually...
She did get kidnapped, I think. Or she disappeared or something.
There's always I know that there was rumours that she got kidnapped,
yeah.
But she never ever said either way. But there's also talk that, you know, she did just go mental and wander away.
I'm a little disappointed that the story didn't tie in, or that the plot of this episode didn't tie in directly to those missing 10 days. And it culminated at her last known appearance. Then the Doctor effectively took her in the TARDIS and they skipped the 10 days.
Yeah, because I...
For no reason other than...
I was actually expecting her to be a companion for those 10 days, but... you know, unacknowledged really in terms of further story.
I think the Doctor claimed to have travelled with Agatha Christie in the Big Finish audios.
Ah.
I like the just Cyberman chest plate and the Carrier Knight.
Yes. Although, of course, the Carrier Knight's a reference to Gareth Roberts' last episode, The Shakespeare Code.
Mm.
Didn't he mention that he had an attic? Whereas he's just pulled it up from the crawl space underneath the console.
Perhaps the console room is in the roof.
Possible.
That is a nice touch of using Death in the Clouds.
Published in the earphone bit.
And they still have battered old pan paper
bags. It's a facsimile edition, it says.
Well, okay.
It's a retro edition. Nice and kitsch.
Classic technology.
Nice that it's done exactly on that year rather than, you know.
5,007,060.
Well, yeah. The year the Earth goes up in flame. Going to Series 1. End of one.
Which, and Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone also survives until then, if you look carefully in the End of the World.
That's true.
Ooh, trailer for Stephen Moffat's.
That was terrible.
Yeah.
Well, I assume she's some kind of computer being, so.
It's not a terribly good trailer. No. Not a patch on Blink, for example.
We have been discussing the downward turn in the quality of the next week trailers. This is Stephen Moffat's two.
But it's still enough to get me really excited about this one.
Yes.
Eurovision.
Yes, the only enemy that can truly defeat the Doctor is the Eurovision Song Contest. Second year running now,
And it's sure to contain acts far scarier than anything that Stephen Moffat could possibly dream up.
They could do a really tongue-in-cheek Eurovision one and get Terry Wogan to narrate during it, and it could have some evil aliens and things in Eurovision. And
Terry Wogan.
I cannot imagine, Sven, that if they did that, you would be impressed. I cannot see that being a good thing.
You could Terry Wogan ripping other European countries. It's funny.
Terry Wogan could become a companion for the week. He could travel with the Doctor.
But of course, Gareth Roberts co-wrote a Big Finish audio in which the Doctor went to the Galactivision Song Contest.
Did he?
Yes, which had various alien races competing. And you discover that Earth's national anthem by this time is I Will Survive.
Classic disco track in the 70s.
But yeah. Perhaps we ought to listen to that next Saturday.
Yes, perhaps we should. Perhaps we should.
Bang, 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 a boom.
Bang, bang, a boom, boom, boom means I love you.
I think is the title of the story when the Big Finish short is. But yeah, I think Gareth Roberts handles the comedy really well. He does.
It's what he's known for.
Yeah, right? It's the pastiche. But I do think it tends to the comic book, if I can put it that way. It's I don't think his scripts or stories will ever be noted for their realism or historical accuracy.
No, perhaps not. But I'm not sure Doctor Who will ever really be noted for its historical accuracy, owing to the large number of giant fire-breathing aliens and clockwork robots that seem to populate. Yeah,
clockwork robots in particular seem to be, you know, endemic around the galaxy.
Indeed.
Oh. Usually dressed up with Christmas, you know, themed accompaniments.
That's true.
I don't think they were clockwork. They were just robots.
They were just robots.
Robot Santas.
Okay.
Nice generic robots.
Yeah.
But there we go, guys. We're at the end of another episode. So, on a second viewing, what is everyone's opinions? Any sort of revised outlooks for them?
I probably thought it was ever slightly better than the first time I saw it, merely because the fact is I got it was supposed to be an ultimate pastiche as opposed to trying to be slightly serious on the first time.
Okay.
First time, so it did make more sense.
Well, it begins with Professor Peach being murdered in the library with a lead pipe. It's not setting yourself up for a serious whodunit.
Well, the thing is, I don't remember names very well, as you might have gathered so far. So.
Yes, but even, it is very tongue-in-cheek. I really, really did enjoy it.
Yeah.
I thought it was a very light, entertaining episode, and I thought that it handled that side of stuff very well. I think that, you know, that is something that Doctor Who can excel at.
Mm.
And I think that although you wouldn't want your episodes like that every single week, for what it was, I thought that it was superbly done.
Yeah, I think I enjoyed this episode the most probably since... certainly since Planet of Ood. But I felt that the... Sontara in two parts and the Doctor's Daughter was a bit of a drier patch.
Mm.
There were good bits and I still enjoyed, it's not that I didn't enjoy them, but they're just a bit mediocre compared to what Doctor Who can and often does do. Mm. And this did help restore confidence that it can still be fun, and I'm really looking forward to Stephen Moffat's two-parter starting in 2 weeks' time, which, despite a slightly rubbish trailer, does look really good.
From the bits and pieces of information that have leaked out, it does sound as if it's going to be one of the meatier stories, mm-hmm. perhaps, this year. But no, on a second viewing, I think the Unicorn and the Wasp holds up fairly well. It's not... five-star material by any means, but as a pastiche of a particular genre, I think it works very well. It's got some very good performances, and yeah, I still think it's probably certainly one of the strongest episodes of this series so far.
Mm.
But again, had it been in any of the first three series, I don't think it would have stood out.
How is your crisis of faith now?
Still on a downturn. I didn't watch The Unicorn and the Wasp on its first broadcast. I had the option of watching that or doing something else, and did something else, knowing that I could catch it later on. Whereas in previous years, I scheduled my Saturday evening around Doctor Who. It's become less and less of a concern. So unless the depth is brought back, unless some serious meaty writing and subjects are brought into it before the end of the series, I'm going to have distinct doubts about the specials next year, and about possibly about the future of the or my future with the programme, watching the programme in general. Because there's far better sci-fi out there already. There's certainly far better drama. The only thing that's kept me watching Doctor Who so consistently so far has been the fact that it's been so enjoyable. As Caleb said, the Sontaran two-parter, and particularly the Doctor's Daughter, were a very rough patch. The Doctor's Daughter was the first time I'd actually sat down and watched an episode and thought that I can think of at least five things I would rather be doing than sitting here watching this. This has upped the quality again, which is something of a relief.
I think it's the enjoyment and the entertainment issue. Yeah. I think that they're going for a broader basis of entertainment and enjoyment, and in doing that, they're seriously undermining themselves. And I think that it is a problem. And certainly, this is the first one that I've, you know, felt that I've been entertained all the way through. Mm. And, you know, episodes that can't maintain that and series that can't maintain that are going to struggle, and I think that the backlash is possibly coming.
Yes.
Yeah. I do think that this series 4 has perhaps had the weakest first half of a series of them so far, because most of the series have had at least one standout episode within the first half, something like Dalek or The Girl in the Fireplace, or Gridlock, one that I've really thought, wow, straight off. And although I've enjoyed the first half on the whole, I felt it lacked that wow factor. And Doctor Who has generally does a good job of being both populist entertainment, but also having enough interest and extra layers to be interesting at the same time, being both popular and intelligent. I felt that perhaps it's kept up the populism, but has been letting the other side down, the intelligence down a bit, and it has lacked a little bit of that sparkle that normally sets it apart from other things, from your Primevals and other Saturday tea time entertainment that is available.
Yes. I'd agree with you on that. I think that pretty much sums up my feelings.
So yeah, I still enjoy it. I'm still positive, but I do feel that probably the time for a rest for the gap here, it is well timed, and hopefully that will hopefully the second half of the series will really pick up, and as they draw the strands together for the finale, then that will work well. But I do think that it does need some element of reinvigoration.
Yes. Stephen Moffat, it's all down to you. Well, there we are for another week. Thank you very much for listening in. Feel free to drop us a line at impossiblepodcast@gmail.com. Visit our Facebook group. The Good Doctor will not be back next week. We will be back with a Eurovision special, so do stay tuned for that. Have a good week.
Bye.
Bye.